Albert Einstein said God doesn't play dice with the universe. Quantum mechanic pioneer Niels Bohr said, Einstein, quit telling God what to do. Who was right? That's the topic today on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. We've been talking to Dr. Enrique Blair. Dr. Blair is on the faculty of electrical and computer engineering at Baylor. He's previously taught at the Naval Academy in Annapolis and is a veteran of the United States Navy, where he spent a lot of time underwater in a submarine. Professor Blair teaches graduate courses in quantum mechanics and quantum computing, and he's the perfect person to talk to about quantum mechanics and quantum computing. Thank you, Dr. Blair, for being back.
Thanks. I am glad to be here. This is a lot of fun.
That's great. We've been talking about quantum mechanics, exactly what it is. We've talked a little bit about the history of quantum mechanics, and we got a little bit into the idea that Albert Einstein didn't like quantum mechanics or certain aspects of quantum mechanics. Was this argument ever brought to resolution to Einstein, or did he die thinking that quantum mechanics was a fluke? What's the history there of this interaction?
Right. You know, that's an interesting question because, as we discussed in a previous podcast, Einstein's work really led to his work was integral to the formulation of quantum mechanics, but he was uncomfortable with a couple parts of it. And the first part, you mentioned his quote about God not playing dice. He did not like the probabilistic interpretation of quantum mechanics so much. He wanted something that was much more deterministic. So that was the first thing there. The second thing he was just not comfortable with was a concept called non-locality in quantum mechanics. So this idea brings up something called entanglement. And so you can entangle quantum systems so that, and you need multiple quantum systems for this, but entanglement means that each subsystem no longer has its own local quantum state. That means that we can't understand its quantum state completely in a local sense. Its quantum state has to be understood in terms of the other systems with which it's entangled. Now, this has some really interesting ramifications, like if you entangle a couple of systems, so like qubits, quantum bits that are zero or one or some superposition of the other. If you entangle qubits and then you separate them a vast distance, you can conduct operations on one qubit that affect the state of the other qubit that's very, very far away. And Einstein did not like this at all. He called that spooky action at a distance.
Yeah, and the weird thing, as I recall, is that the collapse of this entanglement on one end immediately caused the collapse on the other end faster than the speed of light.
That's right. You can have a vast separation between these two particles, and the instant that someone takes a measurement on one particle, let's say she's Alice and she measures her qubit, and Bob has the other entangled qubit. By the way, Alice and Bob, I like to say these are the most famous people in quantum computing.
Yeah, I think they are in philosophy too, and psychology, because everybody uses Alice and Bob. I think it's because of A and B, right?
Yeah.
I betcha.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, so Alice measures her qubit. It immediately affects the state of Bob's qubit. And it doesn't matter how far these things are separated. So people start to think, well, gosh, does that mean we can communicate superluminally?
Okay, that's a big word. Super
faster than the speed of light.
Okay. Gotcha. Is this used in quantum communication, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, but is this something that's used in quantum communication?
Yes, you have to in quantum communication, you have to have entangled pairs of qubits. And I'll just put out a spoiler. Sadly, no, it doesn't allow superluminal communication. We wish it did, but it doesn't.
Yeah, I know. I think the DoD especially spent a lot of money trying to show that you had faster than light communication, and it didn't work for reasons I still don't totally understand. We know that quantum mechanics is used in quantum computers, but actually I think quantum mechanics is part of our daily life. It's all around us. What are some of the places that quantum mechanics is used?
Oh, well, you know, in terms of human users, we use it all the time. You might even say everybody's an expert in it, even children. We're talking, you know, electronic devices, so smartwatches, cell phones, laptops, and supercomputers. All of these have multitudes of transistors used for classical information processing, yet each transistor in itself is a quantum device. It uses quantum mechanics to operate. Those are the, you know, quantum mechanics is in the operating principles of these devices. But we have to point out that we're still processing bits in a classical way. That is, we're using ones and zeros. We're not using quantum bits, these superpositions of ones and zeros.
And I know that you're doing research in quantum mechanics. Now, I think probably the evidence that quantum mechanics is used everywhere is you're in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, not of science.
That's right.
So engineers are people that take science and reduce it to practice. And so some of the things that you mentioned are examples of reduction of things to practice, which use quantum computing. What are some of the things that you're looking at with the application of quantum mechanics?
Right. So I'm really working on two different areas. My first area is molecular computing. And so quantum mechanics governs the operation of these molecular computing devices, but we want to process classical information. So we want to do things like, you know, conventional computing that's, like I said, it's in everything from cell phones to supercomputers. And we want to do this in a way that is energy efficient. And, oh, by the way, we believe these molecules could operate at speeds thousands of times faster than the transistors we're using today. So we like to think that, you know, if we can develop this technology, that would be really helpful for humanity in terms of you know, reducing power consumption, because really the cost of computing in terms of global power production, it's pretty big. I mean, I know that in 2010, it was estimated to be about 10% of global power.
Say that again, 10% of global power is used for computers.
Right.
Wow.
And now you think about it, we've had this boom of cryptocurrencies and our world is much more connected now, and people want the Internet of Things. And so we really need to find ways to reduce power consumption in our
I was
devices.
Even told that for mining of Bitcoins, you gotta crunch a lot of numbers.
Oh,
and
yes.
You generate a lot of heat.
That's right.
And there's actually been people that have moved to cold climates, like in Greenland, maybe
right.
The Arctic, I'm not sure, in order to set up these Bitcoin miners that use all this energy and generate a lot of heat. And they do it there because, well, they can absorb the heat because of the because of the coldness of the environment. Okay.
Yeah.
What are quantum dots? I know you did some work in quantum dots also.
Right. So a simple way to think about a quantum dot is maybe as a particle trap, or a trap for a quantum particle. So you're confining an electron in three dimensions to a point, essentially. And so there are many ways to make quantum dots. So you can make them in semiconductors, or people have taken a crystal and then manipulated some of the atoms to make atomic scale quantum dots. And like I said, I've been interested in molecular computing. So there's a way you can take mixed valence molecules, and then they have these redox centers, reduction oxidation centers, that function as quantum dots. So they trap a mobile charge. And then we want to use those for classical or maybe even quantum information processing.
Okay. I don't understand everything that you're doing with the quantum mechanics, but is it fair to say that as Moore's law continues and computers begin to get speedier and speedier and speedier, we're going to have to do things at a smaller and smaller and smaller scale?
That's
right. And eventually we're going to have to get down to quantum effects.
That's right.
And I think that that's the area that you're working in right now in order to recognize that those quantum effects are going to occur and then make sure that we use them as efficiently as we can.
That's right. Yeah, it's well known that we're running out of room on the roadmap for scaling down our semiconductors. And so that's why I'm interested in new devices that, you know, depart from the transistor paradigm.
You know, Ray Kurzweil, in some of his books, talks about exponential increasing. And anytime you have a doubling of speed, like in Moore's Law, that's an example of exponential increase. But exponential increases are never, ever sustainable. Mm-hmm. You got to get to a point where it doesn't work anymore. If you take the current exponential explosion, say, in the size of computers, you're going to get eventually down to things like Planck lengths, and it isn't going to work there. Right. You're not going to be able to get smaller. So many times this exponential explosion is actually the knee of a kind of an S-shaped curve where the exponential explosion comes up and eventually levels out. Mm-hmm. So it's got to do that someday. I have no idea how far we are from that leveling out. I actually read an article the other day that the speed of artificial intelligence has been outpacing Moore's Law. And this is not only to the increase in the speed of the computer, but the cleverness of the algorithms. Mm. And so people have been doing better and better and better things. Well, let's get to quantum computing. This is the thing that's in the news everywhere. There was the announcement that Google has built a quantum computer that has achieved quantum supremacy. What is quantum computing? For a layperson.
Yeah, that's a good question. So quantum computing really uses quantum systems to process information in a way that our classical computers can't. So classical computers use bits, which that stands for binary digits. And a binary digit can either be 0 or 1, and that's it, 0 or 1. Now, quantum computing uses quantum bits. So you don't just have 0 or 1. You have these quantum superpositions of 0 and 1. And it turns out with quantum superposition and another thing called entanglement, it turns out that you can process information in ways that you can't classically. And the great hope and the great promise there is that there are going to be some applications that quantum computers can do. They can process certain things and do certain calculations efficiently that you can't do on a classical computer. And so there are some well-known examples of this. The best known is Shor's algorithm.
Shor's, that's S-H-O-R-E?
No E.
Oh, just S-H-O-R.
Right.
Okay, Shor's algorithm. What does Shor's algorithm do?
So that is all about defeating a very widely used form of encryption. And this requires factoring very large numbers into two prime numbers.
Okay, and that's the way that a lot of encryption is done today, right? With PGP encryption, and it keeps your communications secret.
That's right.
And with Shor's algorithm, if we got that, we could throw away all those encryptions.
That's right, yeah. And wow. So, yeah, it's the one that it's designed to attack is RSA.
What's RSA?
Rivest something and Adelman. I forget who the S stands for, but okay. Shamir, I think. And
so this is a type of encryption.
That's right.
Okay. Now, if I remember, Shor's algorithm is pretty old. It's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, I think it was 98-ish, so 21 years, something like that.
Okay, so that's one of the things that a quantum computer can do. I like to think of a qubit, again, getting back to Invisible Boy on Mystery Man. That was the one that was actually invisible unless somebody looked at him. So you have all of these qubits there that can be either 0 or 1, and they're all kind of interconnected together, and it's okay as long as nobody looks at them. As soon as somebody looks at them, everything kind of collapses, just like Invisible Boy.
Right.
So that is just strange. And, you know, they had Invisible Boy on Mystery Men because it was so comical. It was so stupid. Yet its application to quantum mechanics seems to be right on. Okay, so we have all of these things. We have Shor's algorithm, which is going to make all decryption obsolete. The common encryption.
Yeah, and that's why governments are so interested in pouring hundreds and millions of dollars into, you know, this sort of research.
Well, yeah. In fact, both countries and companies are just battling in order to get quantum computers. And my understanding is that these different companies are using different quantum mechanisms. Not everybody is using the same approach because quantum exists everywhere, no matter what material you look at. So they're all looking at different sort of quantum materials. Okay, Shor's algorithm. Now, the good news is, which I hope we can talk about in a little bit, not now, is that once we get this Shor's algorithm running and we get all the commonly used decryption made obsolete. We can actually use quantum mechanics to do quantum encryption and actually have something which Shor's algorithm can't crack. So that's the good news in the future. Is that right?
That's right. While quantum computing could take away our RSA encryption scheme, quantum communication could give us something that's provably secure.
Okay, well, that's good. What else besides Shor's algorithm can a quantum computer do?
Yeah, well, there's also a thing called Grover's search algorithm, and that's...
Now, this is not the Grover on Sesame Street.
No, not that little blue guy. I don't think so.
This is another guy. I wonder if that guy gets teased a lot because his name is Grover.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Okay. So what was his algorithm?
So this algorithm is for finding one unique number that maybe it's the solution to a problem, and this one number is found among millions, perhaps, of non-solutions, basically. So it's a search.
So it's kind of optimization, isn't it, in a way?
I wouldn't necessarily... It's not necessarily an optimization. There are other quantum computing paradigms that are more closely related to an optimization, but I wouldn't characterize Grover search as a optimization problem. Really, what's behind this is it's an interference problem. So it's making an interference pattern where all of the probabilities go to zero except one, and then you get that one.
And that's the one that's right. So yeah. You would characterize it as a search algorithm.
Yes.
Looking for a specific number that's determined a priori some way.
Right.
Okay. It's kind of weird. You have these quantum computers. You have all these qubits that are okay. They're floating between zero and one. You don't know which one it is until you look at it. You have to set it up some way, it seems to me, so that when you do look at it, the dominoes fall down and you get the right result.
Yes.
Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization.
Do you know if it takes a long time to set up the dominoes to knock down in a quantum computer?
Well, I don't have a lot of experience with setting these things up, but it's not too terribly long. I mean, not like hours necessarily. I don't think so. I think it could be done in maybe this time scale of seconds.
One of the things is the use of quantum computers, if they ever get them to the point where they're easily usable, will they ever be in our laptops? Will our laptops and our computers ever operate totally on a quantum mechanical principle? Or is quantum computing kind of a separate way of doing things and doesn't relate to the sort of computing that we do on our computers today?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, quantum computing certainly is very powerful. And in theory, quantum computers could do everything that classical computers can do and more. However, quantum computing is so expensive that it's really not feasible, and it won't be for the foreseeable future, to have quantum computers on our laps or in our cell phones. Some of the problems here are that, to get many qubits working together, you really have to isolate them from the environment because of decoherence, which maybe we discussed before. But to isolate from the environment, it means we need specialized equipment like dilution refrigerators, which are massive and use a lot of power. So
do quantum computers use superconductivity in some sense?
Yes. Many of them do. Yes.
And superconductivity requires really, really cold environments.
Right. Yeah. I believe I read in that the Google article about quantum supremacy, they had to cool their system down to 20 millikelvin.
Now, millikelvin is absolute zero. That's where nothing vibrates. If you have heat, things vibrate. And as you reduce the temperature, the vibration slows down. 0 degrees Kelvin is when there's no vibration at all.
That's right.
So this is...
So how, we're 20...
How cold?
We're 20,000ths of a degree away from that.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I don't want that on my lap.
Okay. Well, hopefully... hopefully they can get something which operates at room temperature. Do you know if there's any research going on now where things are working at room temperature?
Well, you know, that's a good question because there are a lot of different ways to implement qubits. And so there are ion traps, and there are one interesting one is these defects in semiconductors. So maybe you have a diamond crystal and you pull out a couple carbons and put in a nitrogen. This gives you a nitrogen vacancy center. And in theory, that you can manipulate qubits that are based on these nitrogen vacancy centers. You can manipulate them and read them at room temperature. If I'm not mistaken, I think even still you have to cool them down so that you get high fidelity readings. But again, I'm not too familiar with all the experimental science behind that. I will be soon, hopefully. I don't know. I'm studying more about these NV centers and maybe more cost effective ways to make them, because diamonds simply expensive. But yeah, it's there are ways to, you know, there are candidates for room temperature quantum computing.
Well, thank you, Eric. We've been talking to Professor Eric Blair at Baylor University about quantum mechanics and quantum computing. We have some topics that we haven't talked about yet. We want to talk specifically about Google's quantum supremacy and what quantum communication is. We'll do that next time on Mind Matters. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.